B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, a man who knows the door code to every on-course restroom in the Southeast, Charlie Nance.
Hey, welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. And this week, the PGA Tour gets back to business with event number one on the 2019-2020 wraparound season at the Greenbrier. And ordinarily, we'd spend a lot of time on that. But not today. Not when you've got a controversy surrounding the Player of the Year vote where Rory McIlroy edged Brooks Koepka. We will take a deep dive into that burgeoning soap opera and more with freelance golf writer Ron Mintz. Also, one of the staples on the Charlotte area golf calendar is the Hope Stout Tournament that takes place every October. The story behind this event and its namesake is truly inspiring and amazing. And since the tournament is now in its 17th year, I think it bears a retelling from Hope's father, my friend Stuart Stout. But we begin today on campus as we start our annual fall tour of area college golf with Andrew DiBattista, head men's golf coach of the University of North Carolina Tar Heels. Well, before we talk golf, I've got to ask about the excitement on campus, because for the first time in I guess all the time that we've talked together, there's some buzz about the North Carolina football program. And I imagine your golf team can be a little distracted on Saturday afternoons right now.
Well, I'll tell you what, we gave the guys off this past weekend, and everybody was at the game Saturday night, and it was by far the best atmosphere that I've ever experienced at Keenan Stadium. And then, you know, you talk to some donors and some other folks that have, you know, been around much longer than I have, and they would actually tell you the same thing. And I thought the coolest part was, before kickoff, the place was packed. There was not an empty seat in the house, and everybody was ready to make some noise. And then, obviously, the game plays out. It's a fantastic game with a fantastic ending, you know, well, I guess if you're a Tar Heel fan. But it was really cool. Our guys were all jacked up about it, really excited. Actually, in our team group text last night, the guys were still sending videos of that winning touchdown in the corner and how loud it was in the student section and all that. So, yeah, certainly a lot of buzz going on here. A lot of good things. We have two other teams on campus that are currently ranked number one in the country. So all we're trying to do is just pull our weight.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Howell goes to my son's rival high school. And, in fact, the high school that he attended was just up from our first house. And I got to see him play the last couple of years. And I'll never forget when I was a boy going to see a football game at Baylor when my sister was there. And it was Steve Young's final year at BYU. And when I saw Sam Howell play last year, it reminded me of Steve Young at BYU. It was like a one-man wrecking crew. It was a one-man army taking on everybody. And he just, even then, watching him in high school, you could tell he had it. So it's been really cool the first couple of weeks to see it. Andrew DiBattista is the head men's golf coach at the University of North Carolina. He's our guest taking dead aim. Before we get into this season, I want to just take a few minutes and look back at how the Tar Heels finished up. Now, when last we spoke, I thought you had really peaked your team at the right time. Your spring season was 6th, 4th, 4th, 1st, 2nd, 5th. You had a bit of a stumble in the conference tournament, but my God, and we just texted after this, a huge bounce back in the Stanford Regional finishing 2nd. How rewarding was that? That was top competition on a great golf course, and your team really showed up.
Yeah, honestly, I'd say that was kind of certainly one of the highlights from last year. And if you go back really throughout the entire spring, like we felt like we were hitting our stride and we felt like we were getting better every single week. And, we saw some really excellent competition literally all throughout the spring. I felt like we saw Arizona State a lot and Texas a lot, even saw Oklahoma State. Yes, they were beating us, but like we were kind of right there with them finishing 2nd, finishing 3rd, 4th, whatever it was. ACC's was a blip on the radar. At a place like this, there's certain pockets of time where life just gets you. It gets you, obviously, from a life standpoint, but from a golf standpoint and from an academic standpoint. And really, it's my fault. I looked at the schedule back in the fall, and I woke up in the middle of the night, kind of had this little panic moment, and started texting Coach Clark, and I said, I think we overloaded the guys at the most critical point, because basically we had our home tournament, we had a weekend off, and then we went down to Florida, and then we came right back, and we went right out to Phoenix for Arizona State's tournament. At the time, it was a late invitation. When we got the invitation, it's like, how do you say no to Arizona State and then competed against Texas and Oklahoma State, and, oh, by the way, the site of the national championship for the next 3 years. You know, we didn't play that golf course for the tournament, but part of the invitation was they were going to have, like, a mini fun tournament practice round deal out at Greyhawk, and then we take a red eye back, and a day later we're at ACC, and the guys are getting ready for final exams. So anyways, blip on the radar. So it was pretty easy to put that behind us because we got to look at the guys and say, that's on us. Like, let's get back to what we were doing. We're playing great golf. School is now kind of ending. Let's just go focus on what we've been focusing on, and boom, you know, all of a sudden we have the best finish ever in the history of the program at a NCAA regional, led by freshman Ryan Burnett, who shot 63 in the final round, which is the lowest score ever by a Tar Heel at an NCAA regional.
Yeah, you know, look, no coach is ever openly happy or satisfied, but realistically, going into last year, replacing the three people that you replaced on the roster, by the way, three of the top players in school history, entering what could have been described as a rebuilding year, to make it that far and to perform that well under those spotlights, it had to at least equal your private expectations of the team, right?
Yeah, I mean, if we're sitting here having a very honest conversation, I would say, yes, last year was a good year, maybe a little bit better than, you know, expectations around our program. And you know me, I like motivation, and I listen to things, I hear things, I pay attention to things. And there are some people, and really even some of our people, some people on campus and some of our biggest supporters, and everybody kept talking about this rebuilding year. It's like, we don't rebuild. We are building to be one of the best, most elite, most consistent programs in the country. Like, that is our goal. That is our vision. And we got to just continually talk to the guys about that. Like, a rebuild, in a weird way, is an insult to you guys because it means that people don't believe in you. Like, you're here for a reason, so let's go out and let's perform. And, you know our program. That's not just on the golf course. That's in the classroom. That's in the community. That's in all areas of life. And I honestly believe that we were really good last year. And now you kind of jump ahead and you look at the future, you look at this year and the future, and now we start to hopefully roll, like really roll.
Yeah, I had a statement made to me by Bobby Bowden when I was working in Tallahassee, and he said, at Florida State, son, we don't rebuild and we don't recruit, we reload. And that's where you want to get to. You want to get into reload mode. Andrew DiBattista is the head men's golf coach at the University of North Carolina, our guest taking Dead Aim. Let's talk about some guys you replaced and some guys coming in. Even though they weren't All-Americans, I believe, and I know that you do too, that when you lose seniors, there's just something about losing that leadership and their presence. And just say a couple of words real quick about the contributions made to the program by the prior Fountains, Josh Martins, and Taylen Songs of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the best way I can describe it is you go back to our end-of-the-year team function, team dinner, team gathering, whatever you want to call it, and it was really emotional. And it wasn't emotional because we said, hey, we're going to miss you guys shooting 63s and 68s and 69s. It was really emotional because of the human beings that those guys are and what they brought to the team every single day from a character standpoint. Josh Martin, one of the comments I made about Josh Martin is I was around him not just for the 4 years during his career, but, I mean, we recruited him for 3 years. And in my entire time knowing him, I literally cannot think of a single time where he said a negative word about anyone or anything. And I think especially in today's world, that's a fairly rare quality. And Pryor and Toby, they're all about service and they're all about taking care of other people. So the message to the team was, you know, obviously thanking those guys for what they did for all of us. But for our guys to understand that, like, these guys, they're creating big holes and we need to fill those holes in their character holes, their team value holes. And that's what we're going to miss about those guys.
Out with the old, in with the new. Your three new freshmen on the roster, George McNeely, Keenan Poole, and let's start with Austin Greaser. By the way, my new favorite name in sports. I love that, Austin Greaser, who decided to announce his presence with authority, as they say, shooting a course record 64 on Sunday at Turning Stone in upstate New York. Wow.
Yeah, he is really good. Very, very, very talented. for some odd reason, he flew under the radar in recruiting. Clarkie and I, we saw him in Greensboro, not this past June, obviously, but the June before that, so whatever that is, 14, 15 months ago. And literally, as soon as we saw him hit a golf ball, we started talking about how he could be an impact guy for us. His recruiting process was one of the most unique that I've ever been a part of, where we saw him play again. He got in a car, he drove down, he visited, and 2 days later he called and verbally committed, canceled all his other visits and committed. So right from day one, it's kind of felt very natural and it's been a great fit. Golf-wise, extremely talented, absolutely bombs the ball off the tee. And when I say bombs, it's not like he hits it 315 in the air and it goes crooked. I mean, it is a absolute laser down the center of the fairway. And I mean, the coolest part about him, for as good as he is, as talented as he is, for a low of scores as he shot already, whether it's in qualifying or in tournament, he's hungry to get better. And he's very, very, very coachable. He's actually come to us several times already and said, you know, hey, what do you think of this? Can I work on this? Can you guys help me with that? And we're actually, if anything, trying to kind of push back by saying, don't worry about that. Like, we'll get to that. Just go be you for right now. Like, you're here for a reason. Just go be you. And really, that's the message with Keenan and George as well. I feel like freshmen, they come in, you know, everything in their environment is new, and they want to be coached. Well, the coaching that we do is we just try to give them confidence. We're not working on your golf swing. We're not talking about technique. Like, you're here for a reason. Just go compete.
Coach Andrew DiBattista, head men's golf coach of the University of North Carolina, our guest taking Dead Aim. If Austin's going to fire a 64 on Sunday, Ryan Burnett decides enough of that freshman, and he does the same thing on Monday. And lo and behold, leading the Heels to victory number one of the season. You can't win them all if you don't win the first one, Coach. So this is how it's going to be every time, including this weekend in Durham, right?
Yeah, that would be really nice. yeah, that would be really, really nice. Then we can, you know, work our way up the North Carolina ladder here. Once you're number one in the country, you just kind of start to blend in a little bit. It's nothing special here, which is one of the cool parts about this place. But the environment we like to have. We like competition. And I think what we are hoping to see this year, and we've already seen it early, is the internal competition. Because we've had this conversation so far, and we still haven't even mentioned our All-American senior Austin Hitt.
Oh yeah,
right. So
yeah, we're getting there. We're getting there.
I know, but you get this young guy who comes out and he shoots 64 and he breaks the course record, and you know his photos up on social media and the articles about him. Well, now you got some guys. You got an Austin Hitt. You got a Ryan Burnett. You got a Ryan Gerard and Dougie Hergett and plenty of others that are saying, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, young man!" Like, hold on a second. You're not the new sheriff in town just yet. Let me do a little something about it. And hopefully all of that continues throughout the year, just with the internal competition and these guys really fueling and feeding off of one another.
You know, along those lines, just looking at your roster, you have got to like where you are. You've got so much youth with so much experience. You mentioned Hitt. He's your only senior. By the way, I feel like he just got there, so I think I'm getting old. But, you know, you mentioned Gerard and Ergood and Burnett. These guys have logged serious rounds for you. And, I mean, Gerard's a junior. Ergood and Burnett are sophomores. They've logged serious rounds for you in competition already.
Yeah. And, well, it's interesting, you know, after the win, lots of phone calls, lots of emails, lots of positive stuff. And I was talking to one of our, you know, biggest supporters, and he basically said, he goes, "I just realized Bernie's a sophomore." And I was like, "Yeah." He's like, "He feels like he's been around forever." He's like, "How is he a sophomore?" And I'm like, "Yeah. I mean, you still have him for three more years." And we've been watching him for a while and feel like he's not even anywhere near his potential. Like, he's an excellent ball striker, but there's other areas of his game that he can improve upon. And then even the ball striking, like, that can always get better. That can always be more consistent. And, again, you talk about now the internal competition in the team, like, we don't really have to say much because they just kind of look around, right? And they realize, like, wow, like, I really need to execute. I need to perform. I need to pick it up. Like, otherwise, you know, whether it's they don't want to be the three guy, they don't want to be the five guy, they don't want to be left behind. I mean, whatever it is, like, there's a lot of motivation around here right now.
Coach, we spoke earlier of Greaser and your other newcomers, and we just talked about your sophomores. Is it my imagination, and I'm out there seeing these guys in high school and junior golf right now, is it my imagination, or is the level of on-course ability and competence and competitiveness coming out of high school and junior golf, it gets better and better each year? I keep waiting for it to plateau a little bit, but these guys just get better and better. I mean, as much as the kids coming out on tour from college are ready to compete and win immediately, it seems that's the way going into college now, too.
Yeah, I think, just resources, technology, opportunity, all of that stuff. Everything is now at a higher level, more elite level. Again, you just go back to resources and you get a tool like TrackMan if you're fortunate to have access to that. There's so many opportunities in junior golf now, right? Before it was kind of like AJGA, and if you're not playing the AJGA, nobody knows you. Well, is it nice to play in AJGA events? Yes. But, if you look at Keenan Poole, did he play in some AJGAs? Absolutely. But he also did a lot of local and regional and, some state stuff, and that's where he learned how to play. Right? At the end of the day, there's still a little white golf ball down there in front of you, and there's hopefully some green grass, and then there's a hole at the end. And all the other stuff, it can, in a weird way, kind of distraction. Right? At the end of the day, it doesn't really matter who else is in the field. You're just trying to bring your best stuff to the golf course every single day.
Look, if I've heard you say it once, I've heard you say it 1,000 times about junior golf. Just score low on the golf course and score high in the classroom, and trust me, we'll find you.
Yeah, people are going to find you. There's enough coaches out there, and there's enough really smart coaches who pay attention. Somebody's going to find you.
Get you out of here on this. Andrew DiBattista is the head men's golf coach at the University of North Carolina, our guest taking Dead Aim. This week, I sort of touched on it. You're competing at Duke's tournament, the Rod Meyers. You'll get a look at Charlotte and Duke and UNCG and Wake and ECU, among others. This early in the year, is it easier or harder to compete against the devils you know? Or in a perfect world, would you like to wait a little while before mixing it up with conference and area teams?
Oh, no. You know us. We'll compete anytime, any place, anywhere against anyone. And again, I think the big thing for us is kind of sticking to our process, focusing on ourselves, and really focusing on the golf course. We've even made adjustments just early this year on how we prepare for tournaments and how we prepare specifically for each golf course. So do we always want to beat up on Duke? Absolutely. Wake Forest? Absolutely. but we're going there talking about the golf course. We had our team meeting yesterday. We'll kind of get locked in on our strategy and our plan, and hopefully we can execute just like we did a couple weeks ago in New York.
That guy is one of the finest men in the college game for sure. That's Andrew DiBattista, head men's golf coach of the North Carolina Tar Heels. And up next, we take Dead Aim at the history and legacy of one of the events on the fall golf calendar in the Charlotte area, the Hope Stout Golf Classic, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
We are Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. Stuart Stout is my friend, and he's also the guiding force behind the March 4th with Hope Foundation. His annual Hope Stout Golf Classic is in its 17th year as one of the staples of the Charlotte golfing calendar, and we had the chance to catch up earlier this week. Stuart, it's funny. My wife and I got to Charlotte in 06, and being a golfer, I started to hear about this Hope Stout tournament, and I didn't know that it was a person. I thought maybe it was an organization. I had no idea. Anyway, it already was and has remained a staple on the Charlotte golf calendar, happening every Columbus Day. And not too long after that, I met you, and this is where it gets embarrassing. I knew you for at least a year before I put two and two together, that you are that stout and that Hope was your daughter. This year is the 17th edition of your tournament, and it occurred to me when we ran into each other a couple of weeks ago that, now there's a whole new generation of folks and a whole new generation of philanthropic golfers out there that don't know your story, that don't know Hope's story, and that don't know the tournament story. And so I want to begin by saying thank you for doing this today. And, I know it can't be easy, but thank you so much.
Well, Chuck, I appreciate it. And yeah, it is it's staggering to me that it's been 17 years. I mean, Hope was 12 when all of this happened, and she's been gone much longer than we actually had her. And, you know, time just drips by, and it goes in a hurry. But I really appreciate the kind words. It is a testament to the people that have supported our efforts and our daughter's story that we keep doing this tournament every year, and we're looking forward to the 17th edition of it. And how it really got started is really the, you know, it kind of ties into what we were doing. And so, you know, in June of 2003, we were just like every other family that has three kids. My oldest daughter was a rising senior, or actually eighth senior at Weddington, and my middle daughter was a sophomore, and Hope was in the seventh grade. And we were just an atypical family, and then Hope had some knee pain that turned out to be our parents' worst nightmare. It was a very rare and aggressive form of bone cancer.
If you don't mind me asking, my sister is a bone cancer survivor. What did she have?
She had osteosarcoma.
Osteosarcoma, okay. My sister had Ewing sarcoma of the right femur.
As you know, generally speaking, osteo and most bone cancers are very slow-growing.
Yes.
And they manifest themselves with a lot of pain. In this case, it was just the opposite. She had a lot of pain late in the disease, and it already spread. And so we started a very aggressive chemotherapy treatment in the summer of 2003. And then in August, as Hope was finishing up her chemo, her first couple rounds, a bunch of my buddies got together and held a golf tournament for us. And it was a surprise to me until I drove up that day and I couldn't believe it. I figured they'd get, you know, a couple foursomes or whatnot, but they sold out Firethorn Country Club. There were 36 teams, actually more. They turned it away, and we raised a lot of money for our family. And Hope subsequently went through chemotherapy, but, you know, her real story was the Make-A-Wish story. You know, Make-A-Wish came to her in late November and asked her what her wish was going to be, and she proceeded to blow them out of the water by saying, you know, I've been very lucky. At age 12, I've gotten to go to Cancun and swim with the dolphins. We go to the beach all the time. I've been to Disney World. My wish is to grant all the other kids their wishes. And, of course, this is very hard for most people to believe now. The only way that the word got out was not social media, because it didn't exist.
Right.
You had AOL online was about it. And it was newspaper and print and radio. And, of course, Keith Larson picked this story up off of the front page of The Observer in December. And that whole period of time from that mid-November moment to Hope's passing, you know, less than a month and a half later, Make-A-Wish in the city of Charlotte, and the Panthers got on a roll and went to the Super Bowl, and we met Kevin Donnelly through the whole thing, and $1 million was raised. But as it relates to us and what we did, while Hope was in the hospital, there was a lady there whose child had kidney cancer, and my wife went and spent some time with this lady, and she found out that her daughter had relapsed on the same day she lost her job. And she and my wife had a moment, and Shelby came in the room and had been crying, and Hope said, "Mom, what's, you know, going on?" And we were very honest with Hope throughout her whole disease and whole process. And so we told her what was happening. And and she just said, "Dad, go help that lady. Go give her some money." You know, typical 12-year-old. And so after this tournament was over, they raised about $40,000, and that was Hope's Miracle Fund. And it was really for our family in case we had to fly to somewhere to get a bone
right.
marrow, which unfortunately wasn't the case. And so after all of her final expenses and everything, these guys try to write me a check. And my wife and I remembered that promise we made. And so we took the money and rolled it into the March 4th with Hope Foundation. March 4th was Hope's birthday, March 4th, 1991. And so we made a promise to our daughter that we were going to do something to help. I had no idea that we'd still be running a foundation 17 years later. But the second year of this rolled around, we did the first Hope Stout Golf Classic. And that is one of our primary fundraisers to fund the March 4th with Hope Foundation.
Stuart Stout, my friend and Hope Stout's father, is our guest taking Dead Aim. The moment when your daughter says that to the Make-A-Wish Foundation, unprompted by you, uncoached by you and your wife, that was her legitimate, honest wish. You hear that out loud. What is your reaction? What is your physical reaction to that?
Well, You have kids, and they're all different. You know, each child has a different personality and a different temperament and all this. Holly, our middle daughter, and Austin, our oldest, had worked with Make-A-Wish when they were students at Weddington Senior High. And so Make-A-Wish had a connection to our family, not to me. I knew who Make-A-Wish was. I didn't know much more about them, but Holly and all the classmates. I mean, we live in Weddington. It's a pretty tight-knit community. It was very tight-knit and small back in those days. So everybody kind of knew what was going on with us. And so the money was already raised by the students and the families and the support we got at Weddington High School. Make-A-Wish, on the other hand, was broke. They didn't have any money. I mean, it was, having run a nonprofit for 17 years, I understand that. you live and die by your donors. And so Make-A-Wish just didn't have an infrastructure here, and so they had no money. But yet here was this wish opportunity. And so when they came to our house, for about a week, we were trying to find out what Hope really wanted to do. Was it go to Disney World? Did she want to go to New York? And at that time, she was pretty much bedridden. So whatever was going to happen pretty fast, and it had to be something that, you know, she could do. And so the night of the visit, the Make-A-Wish Foundation came, and they started asking Hope all these questions. And we started suggesting things. I said, you know, Hope, Pebble Beach is a great place to go.
You know, it's not your Make-A-Wish, Stuart.
Yeah. Oh, buddy. And then my wife said, well, you know, we can go to New York and get on Oprah's Favorite Things. And the girls were like, yeah, I hope we can go this. And finally Hope said, wait a minute, whose wish is this? Just what you said. And then she said, tell me about the other kids, because you mentioned there were 155 kids ahead of me. And, of course, it was very delicate because the Make-A-Wish people couldn't come out and say, well, honey, you know, you're very sick. We need to get you quick.
I mean, right.
They couldn't say that. But the fact was her wish was funded. And so Hope unraveled that and just said, well, my wish is to grant all of their wishes. And it stunned everybody in the room. But the poor wish granters were like, oh, my gosh, now what do we do? And the more they tried to talk her out of it, the more resolved. And I knew right away when they started that, away, it's the worst path you could go down. So I walked 3 very stunned wish granters out to my front door, and they said, this is a million-dollar wish. Because at the time, a wish was somewhere around $6,000 times 155. That's eating up $1 million pretty quick. And Hope, by the way, also, oh, by the way, you can get this done before Christmas. And this was in mid-November.
Wow.
And you were here, I think, if you were here, people remember that period of time was magical in that you had the Panthers who very unexpectedly got on a roll. Hope had met Kevin Donnelly during the season. I've had season tickets since day one, and we met Kevin because the Panthers got us on the field in October when she could still walk around, and she and Kevin became friends. Kevin came over to the house literally every Friday on his off day and spent time with Hope. And so all of that sort of kind of snowballed. Pat McCrory, who was mayor at the time, called it the perfect storm. It really was.
Stuart Stout, my friend, Hope Stout's father, leader of the March 4th with Hope Foundation. It's an unbelievable organization. He's our guest, Taking Dead Aim. Hope passes away just a couple of months after this.
Mm-hmm.
And this is now year 17, and the foundation has continued, and the tournament has continued. And there's a part of you that goes, you know what? I think we did all the good work that Hope wanted us to do. Is it time for us to, you know, pass the torch on to someone else? What is your motivation that keeps you going? How many times throughout the year when you're doing events, and it's not just the golf tournament, but with other events, do you sort of go, you know, I think we did her proud today? Where do you see this going? Do you see yourself being a major force and a major part of this ad infinitum, or do you see a point where you do step away?
Well, there's always a time when you have to lay it down, and we're not there yet, but a lot of people do know that there was a movie effort last year and a half ago. We thought we had finally...
I thought this was getting close because you and I even discussed people who had been cast, and there were serious people who had been cast and who were involved in the pre-production on this thing.
That's right. Queen Latifah was cast to be the wish granter role, and there was a young lady that was going to play Hope, who was phenomenal. And believe it or not, Chuck, they had signed 3 days before these guys blew it up. They signed J.J. Watt to play Kevin Donnelly.
Oh, wow.
And so I only say that because it fell apart. Movies, of course, are notorious for that. But the people that were running this was a major studio called Alcon Entertainment. And for whatever reason, it fell apart. And we've been spending the last year and a half trying to pick the pieces up from that. But I don't want to get into that because that'll work itself out. But to answer your question more specifically, yeah, I mean, we would love at some point to be able to pass the torch to someone. Running a foundation is very difficult. It's very hard work. We are very lucky in that we've got three primary events that kind of keep the doors open because we have very, very little overhead. My wife and I run the foundation on a very, very, very part-time basis. We have wonderful volunteers. We have the golf tournament. We have the gala in the spring, which is going to be a hoot this coming March. And then we have an event in town called the Spirit of Hope, which is run by a cheerleading company. And we're benefactors from that. We don't really get involved with that. But, yeah, we would there come a time when we have to say, you know, it's time to pass along. But we're not there yet. We do have an opportunity, I think, based on the disaster that was the movie. From the ashes comes a guy out of the woodwork who's apparently going to get this thing pinned back up and ready to go, and it might be even bigger and better than we ever thought.
Fantastic. Well, let's get to the golf tournament, because as I started this interview by saying, it is a staple on everyone's golf calendar. As someone who was just in a meeting less than a week ago planning a tournament in October, they were like, well, what dates are we looking at? I said, well, I know one date you're not touching because no one else will play in it. I said, there, you got the Hope Stout tournament coming up Columbus Day. That date is taken. And everybody's, oh, yeah, yeah, I'm playing in that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So let's talk about the Hope Stout tournament. Is it full at this point?
No, it is not. And one of the reasons why is that what you just mentioned is, you know, we've had this event out at the at Ballantyne, the resort course, for years. And we have always had it on Columbus Day until this year.
Oh, you're not doing it on Columbus Day this year. Okay.
Well, it's actually a week earlier. It's October the 7th. And the reason is they're owned by some big conglomerate now. And they basically kicked us a year ago, kicked us off of that date. And so we're a week early. It's October the 7th. We do have spots available. We have sponsorships available this year, which I'm kind of glad about because, you know, you have, as time passes, we've had wonderful participation and support from a lot of companies. But as you know, companies come and go. There was one big, huge sponsor we had for years, and they got bought out, and, you know, things happen. But First National Bank has been our primary sponsor, even going back into the American Community Bank days. Our friends over at Form Technologies and Domtar are supporting us in a big way. But, yeah, there's spots available. There's team spots available. And to get to that, you just go to our website, and you can register right online.
The website is March4thWithHope.com, March4thWithHope.com, and you can go to the upcoming events tab, and there's the golf tournament. It's the Hope Stout Golf Classic now, 17 years. And real quick, I know that all this got started because of the Make-A-Wish Foundation, but talk about what the tournament and what the foundation actually benefits at this point.
The March 4th Hope Foundation, although we do support Make-A-Wish, what we do is we help families at a much more granular level. We're helping families that are in the hospital, have a child in the hospital, with rent payments, mortgage, transportation, and utilities. So we've raised and spent, since inception, Chuck, over $1 million doing this. And that's what we're proud about, because I know Hope would be very thrilled with us. And so we want to help a lot more. So come out and play the tournament. We love having some new faces out there. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Stuart Stout is the kind of guy that you can just spend a few minutes with, and you're a better person for it for the rest of your life. Sign up for the Hope Stout Golf Classic at March4thWithHope.com. And when we return, freelance golf writer Ron Mintz takes dead aim at the controversial Player of the Year vote that went down this week, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
Taking That Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. Ron Mintz is a freelance golf writer whose work has graced the Sporting News, Fansided.com, and many others. Friday, we had the chance to take a deep dive into a pretty controversial subject this week on the PGA Tour.
Ron, I want to start where, it looks like a great soap opera piece that happened this week. If you would have told me that Rory McIlroy was going to be voted over Brooks Koepka by his peers as player of the year, I'd have said you were crazy, because if there's one thing that I've learned about golfers over the years is they value major championships over everything else. And when you look at the major championships last year, it's a no contest. I mean, even if you throw out the total bit spitting that Rory did in his own backyard at Royal Portrush, even if you throw that out, in the three majors in which they both competed, Brooks still spotted him 21 shots. So I was stunned by this. I guess I shouldn't be stunned. Were you?
Well, I thought it was going to be close for a couple of reasons. By the way, this is the first time since 1992, I believe that's correct, that the PGA and the PGA Tour Player of the Year has not been the same. So the PGA uses a mathematical formula, awarding more points for majors, et cetera. The PGA Tour just lets the players vote. It's like an election, and you don't have to vote. You have to have played at least 15 events during the year to get a vote. And Brooks Koepka said he didn't even vote, not this year, but previous year. So, and another thing, they don't release the tally. They don't tell you how many votes the players got. Where the PGA does. So it's two completely different systems. But I think this year, several writers think that the players went on the side of the FedEx Cup and the Tour Championship because, that's where their money comes from. And one writer, Michael Bamberger with golf.com, said that, it shouldn't be a surprise that they would go where the money is, but they feel like, other writers have said the same thing, they feel like that the PGA Tour players shun the major this year and picking Rory as player of the year.
Well, see, and I'm a great conspiracy theorist, so I'm going to go ahead and throw one down now. Because, as you mentioned, the vote is done in anonymity, we will never know what the vote tallies were or who voted for what. And because this was a PGA Tour vote, could it be now that the PGA Tour, and I love to throw this out, that they could have sided with the guy who won the Players' Championship, their quote-unquote major, and won their FedEx Cup, as opposed to the guy who says, I don't really try in regular PGA Tour events, I only care about the majors, and by the way, they need to do something about slow play out here. So you've got one guy who's sort of an enigma to the PGA Tour, and one guy who's the golden boy of the PGA Tour. And I just wonder if maybe, just maybe, there was some funny business in tallying the votes, because that's the kind of thing I like to think about, Ron.
Well, I agree. I mean, as mentioned, the writer Michael Bamberger, he said, and this is a quote, players were sending a message to their biggest sponsors of their biggest events, the good people who backed their two biggest events when they selected Rory McIlroy. So he's suggesting that they're looking where their money comes from. And I have to say, on the theory of your conspiracy theory,
it sounds crazy, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't. You get players, and here's Brooks, who's come out months ago and said, well, this is how I look at it. Half the field's going to miss the cut, and then half the guys that make the cut are going to fall out after Saturday. And the 30, 35 left, I know I can beat at least 30 of them every week. And
which, by the way, is the exact same thing Jack Nicklaus said three decades ago.
Yeah, he did. But I think that rubbed these guys wrong. And I'll read you a quote in a minute from Rory McIlroy. I think we've got a genuine, real rivalry started between Brooks and Rory, and this is just the start. And it may be great. You know, we always wanted that. We always wanted Tiger and Phil to have that rivalry. But this one, I think this one is getting a little personal already. So it's going to be exciting to see how it plays out.
Freelance golf writer Ron Mintz is our guest taking Dead Aim. This just gets more and more delicious. And Brooks is the kind of guy who's so snarky and so sarcastic that with every win he has this next year, he's going to mention something about, I hope everyone takes notice of this when we vote at the end of the year. That's the kind of guy he is. I think he's a grudge holder, and I think he keeps score.
Well, I mean, basically, he and Rory both had three wins, although Brooks did have a major with the PGA. Brooks had 9 top tens. Rory had 14. And Brooks started 21 tournaments. So a lot of people are saying he's not playing in that many regular events. He's just playing in the majors. But that's not true. I mean, he actually played in 2 more events than Rory did.
Well, and I just, I'm sorry. I don't care how you do, and I guess I'm old school about this. I mean, in 1953, I think Ben Hogan played 5 times. He won 3 majors and had a top 10 in the 4th, and, you know, I don't know what happened in the 5th. He played 5 events, won 3 majors, and he's player of the year. I don't care if you won 11 events across the tour. I just don't. Major championships mean the most. And when I look at a guy like Brooks Koepka, who in the biggest tournaments, when the lights are on the brightest, all he does is finish in the top 5 every time or win the dang thing. I mean, I just kind of go, okay, this is the man right now. And if you don't like it, I don't care what you do in Des Moines, go out and beat him. And oh yeah, by the way, if it's your tournament, if it's the Open Championship in your home country at a course you have lobbied to get, don't take a snowman on the first hole. Don't spit the bit on worldwide television and when the bright lights are on. I just can't get past that for McIlroy voting player of the year. And don't get me wrong, I'm in love with Rory McIlroy. I think he's one of the greatest golfers I've ever seen, and I could watch him play 10 days out of 10. But I just cannot get past what happened at Royal Portrush and just forgive it because he played well on Friday to try to make up for what he did on Thursday. He still missed the cut and got smoked.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on my soapbox about this, Ron. I apologize.
No, I agree with you. I mean, you look at the PGA the way they do it. And they have a formula. You can go to their website and see it. But they get points for victories as a starting point. But a player earns 3 times as many points for a major as he does a regular tour event. And rightly so. And the total, just FYI for your listeners, was kept to 84 points and McIlroy 78. So the 6 points difference. But Rory got 20 points for his player's win. So I think that the way the PGA of America does it does weigh the majors and treats them with the respect, I agree with you, that they deserve.
And if you're telling me that PGA Tour players all of a sudden have turned their back on the majors, see, I'm just not buying that after decades of voting that majors are the most important, unless we've gotten a bunch of guys now who are voting who say, you know what, I'm never going to win a major, so I might as well vote for the guy who's going to win the most of the stuff that I'm going to compete in. I can't wrap my head around that, Ron.
Well, a lot of people suggested that, like I said, Brooks had sort of upset some of the players talking about, if it was a popularity contest, Rory would definitely have won, basically. But they're both well-liked by their peers, but his candor, I think, has turned a lot of people off. He downplays just about every other event except the majors, and then he talks about other players and their long warm-up and how they play slow. I mean, he said a lot of things. You know, he wanted to be recognized more and get more attention, and he certainly got it this past year in the media. I mean, everything he said was in print, and he said some things that upset some players. So I do think there was some popularity factor in the PGA Tour vote. I'm sorry.
No,
I don't think it was just FedEx.
I think you're right. I don't debate that at all. And in a way, though, I find it sad because it's not like – I forget the bozo's name who was just at the U.S. Tennis Open, the Russian player who was, you know, chastising the fans and flipping them off and whatnot. And he was just a jerk. It's not like Brooks was acting like that guy. Brooks was asked pointed questions. He gave candid, honest responses. And it's not like what he said was not the opinion of a ton of people. He's just the only one who had the stones to actually step up and say something. And in a, you know, a player of his stature with his responsibility, he's the guy who should say something. And for him to be punished for that, I think is somewhat unfair.
Well, I agree. I mean, he's sort of like Tiger in a way. I mean, Tiger would come in and they'd say, "How do you think you're going to do this week?" And every week he'd say, "I'm going to win." He said, "I wouldn't be here if I wasn't, didn't think I was going to win." And that's sort of the way Brooks is doing it, but maybe a little bit a smile on his face, where Tiger, except for the last few years, he didn't ever smile in front of the media. It was, "I'm here to win the tournament," and that was his answer. But I've got a quote for you. This is another telling thing that even Rory said he thought Brooks should have won. And this quote, he says, "I thought Brooks winning the PGA Championship would be the difference maker, but the other players thought differently." And he said, "Players don't just feel that 4 weeks a year is important. It's a huge vote of confidence from the players that we play for more than just what the narrative suggests." So in one hand, he's saying Brooks deserved it. But then he says he agrees with the PGA Tour players that it shouldn't just be about the majors. So I took that as sort of a jab, you know, a politically correct jab at Brooks from Rory. And that's when I think I told you when we talked earlier in the week, I see a rivalry going here. And even in his sort of congratulations to Brooks, he threw that in there.
We'll get off this subject with this quote. I just saw this on Twitter and retweeted it a few minutes before our conversation. And it's from Michael Breed. It's the best, most succinct argument I've seen to this. Here's what the quote said. "One simple question. Is there a kid in America right now standing over a putt saying, 'This putt is to win the tour championship'? And the answer is no." And I went, "Oh my God, there it is. I wish I'd have been that smart to just say that all along instead of ranting like a madman." Freelance golf writer Ron Mintz is our guest taking Dead Aim. Before we started this conversation off air, we were talking about new players and rookie of the year. And you came across an article talking about up and coming players to watch this year. And in fact, some that we like to watch aren't included on this list. But let's talk about a guy that you and I are both very high on. And that's Victor Hovland.
Yeah, I think everybody is. There was an article on PGAtour.com and all their writers and several sites. I think I've looked at probably 10 different major media outlets, and everybody is saying Victor Hovland's, you know, he should be Rookie of the Year this year. He should have gotten his card last year, but because of the U.S. Open rule, he wasn't able to count those points where he had a good finish, so he had to go back to the Corn Ferry Tour and play in those playoff events, but he did secure his card. But he's the real deal. And of course, Matthew Wolff and Morikawa won last year, so they're not considered rookies this year. But Hovland played 6 weeks on the tour last year, had a fourth place finish at the Wyndham, and I just think he's going to be the Rookie of the Year. I mean, there's some good other good ones like Scottie Scheffler, who won the Corn Ferry and the playoffs. And then you've got Tom Lewis. Everybody's high on him. Doug Ginn, Maverick McNealy, and, of course, Scott Harrington. You and I were talking earlier, 38 years old, and he, I think, was in second place this week after – or last week after the Greenbrier. So a lot of great guys, but I think Victor stands out head and shoulders above all of them.
Yeah, I like Hovland an awful lot, and I've always been in love – with Matthew Wolff for this reason. When you see somebody who has that unique a swing, that is obvious no one has taught him that. That was something he just developed. It's like looking at Jim Furyk. Anybody who has that kind of swing and has made it to that level of golf, you know that they're not going to have swing faults down the stretch. They're used to performing under pressure, and that swing is going to hold up under pressure. And because of that, because of its uniqueness and because of his aggressiveness, and you and I may have talked about this before, I really think that Matthew Wolff has the potential, and I'm throwing this out there, and I'm just a big name, has the potential to be like Arnold Palmer in terms of the way people root for him, because that swing has an everyday Muni quality about it that everyone can identify with.
Oh, exactly. And he's already made it clear he's not changing it.
No, why wouldn't you?
Well, that's what everybody else says. I mean, even Brandon, some of the guys that break down flaws in swing, said, "Look, as long as he can bring that club face back square to the ball, it doesn't matter how he got it there. And he's got the swing speed to hit it a mile. So he's not changing the swing. And he's not cocky, but he's very confident for a rookie. And I think another reason is we're seeing so much parity in college golf now. You know, years ago, when both of us were younger, Wake Forest dominated for a while. And now, you know, I love to watch the NCAA championship on the Golf Channel. I never really cared that much about college golf, but it's just fascinating to see these players like Victor and Wolf and Hovland, Morikawa, and then they turn pro, and it's like they just went from one tour to another. It's not a big jump for them anymore like it used to be.
Well, earlier in the show, I had Andrew DiBattista, the head men's golf coach at the University of North Carolina, on, and we were talking about one of his freshmen, the last name is Greaser, went out in the very first tournament and shot a course record, shot a 64 as a freshman in his very first college tournament. And I see this with my son out and about on the junior circuit and in high school tournaments. As great as these players are who are coming out of college and ready to compete at the pro level, it is getting like that at the college level too. Kids are coming out of high school and junior golf, and there's no longer a learning curve. They're ready to step right in and be one of the top five players in the program from the age of 18 and start rocking and rolling. It is really amazing the quality of golf at the college level.
Oh, it is, and I saw an article this week, and I don't remember the college, and I don't remember the player because he's 12 years old. But he was offered a full scholarship with one of the major golf universities. I can't think which one it was, but he's already got a scholarship offer, and he's 12. And, you know, the junior tour comes to North Carolina every year at Sedgefield where the Windhams played. And Jordan Spieth played there as a junior, Patrick Reed. I mean, if you want to see the superstars of tomorrow, go to that junior event each year they have up there at Sedgefield. It's put on by the same tournament director that does the Wyndham, Mark Brazil, and you'll see the future stars. That's where they're coming from.
That's freelance golf writer Ron Mintz. I'd also like to thank Stuart Stout of the Hope Stout Golf Classic and Andrew DiBattista, head men's golf coach of the North Carolina Tar Heels, for their time and insight this week. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show, wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, BePod Studios, Spotify, all the usual podcast outlets, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Featured there now, links to articles on the latest goings-on in and around the game. Hey, weather-wise, a hot one. But a weekend with plenty of opportunity for teeing it up and letting this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. And hey, if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golfguy. And I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.